Henry Ron here with Steve Alzinga, and we're returning to the class that focuses on influence. And we're on now the 9th presentation, on influencing wrecking habits.
Right.
And each presentation starts with not walking with God. Now, a while ago, you were talking about this talking, listening repeatedly, and then listening is the word of God.
Yeah.
And I want to call attention to something we're doing. All of these sessions, on the 9th one now, are dealing with passages from the Bible.
Right.
So if you can walk with God and open God's Word, a lot of these things about influencing others will be given to you daily.
Right.
To you yourself, to your spouse and you, to your family and you, your church. In some ways, there's a culture of feeding being an influential person.
Yes. In the Bible, I majored in psychology in college. And, it was good. But, when I started studying the Bible, I thought, this is better.
Right.
I thought, as a psychological book that explains why people do what they do, that the Bible is so filled with so many things that it blew away most of the courses that I took where I was supposed to be learning that stuff. So the Bible really does have a lot of stuff in there to help you with just practical everyday life, how to live and how to succeed in life, and then how to help others do the same thing. So it's good stuff in there. Why not access it every day?
Right. And over time, how you will be encouraged in being a person of influence.
Right.
Well, let's keep going on here. Here's one: not taking care of your family. Proverbs 14, verse 1: the wise woman builds her up, or the wise woman builds her house, but with her own hands, the foolish one tears it down.
Right.
Why is the taking care of a family so crucial for being a person of influence?
Well, there's another passage, where is it, in Timothy or something, where the instructions
for being a minister.
If you don't take care of your own family, then how can you take care of the family of God?
Right.
So that verse suggests that your family is the first ministry entity that you have.
Right.
It's the first and it's the most important. If you're not taking care of that, then how in the world can you take care of something else? You're going to ignore your most important one to do some other one?
Yeah.
And that doesn't make any sense. And I think, too, in the family, this is a great place to learn how to do ministry. Because your family has people that are different from one another. They have different needs. Generally, you're attracted to a spouse that's opposite from you.
Yeah,
so now you have
to
learn how to deal with someone who's opposite.
Right.
And it's a great place for learning how to be a person of influence. If you can't even influence your own family, then how are you going to influence others? It's a great indicator and a great place to practice. It's the same stuff that you do in your home that you do with other people.
Well, we often talk about the 7 connections that way, and there's each levels. And if you're successful with your spouse, and she wants to follow you and you want to follow her, and the same with your family, it does set up the seed of influence.
Right. Well, first of all, you have an influence over 1 million people in your family.
Yeah,
great, 400 years. So, but also, it's the same tools, same things, if you want to influence your children, which most parents do, you want to influence them for the right, you want them walking with God, all those things that you do to help your kids is the same stuff you would do with a friend or someone at work or, encouraging, sometimes telling the truth in love, all these different ways that we influence people, it's all the same stuff.
Right. And often you'll notice strong families know how to give leadership.
Yeah.
And
vice versa, when someone is a really good leader, making a big company happen, often it's their family that brings the whole thing down.
Right.
They got all this problem, someone sued somebody. Messy divorce, and the job work gets dragged into it.
Right.
some of the same issues.
Well, let's reflect a little bit. With her own hands, the foolish parent, we'll just put it that way, mm-hmm. tears their family down.
Yeah.
Why would anybody do that? I mean, in some ways, it seemed like you have, you know, again, we can comment on divorce as an example mm-hmm. to break down and the impact on the yeah. children. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, we stay together for divorce, or, you know what, we're getting a divorce and it really doesn't matter because, you know, it's better for them to see us separated and happy with each other mm-hmm. than being in the same relationship. Right. I mean, right. my point is there's all this different spins mm-hmm. on the tearing things down.
Right. Yeah. I think sometimes parents, because they lack self-esteem for themselves, in a weird way, don't want their kids succeeding. Because if they succeed, then you're doing better than me, you look better than me, you're doing better in school than I ever did. And then they start tearing them down, like to keep it the same. Keep us, instead of having that sense that
I'm going to launch.
Whatever my kid does, I get credit for.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If he does better than me, I did better than me. I mean,
but
it seems like there's this competition. People with, you know, didn't get much encouragement when they were growing up, and now they're short of it. You know, the kid comes home with A's, and it's like, well, you're better than me. You're smarter than me. And then they tear him down.
Right.
So I think it's a lot of, you know, poor self-esteem. It's not having a secure sense. And again, that relates to a walk with God.
Right.
If you have a walk with God, you know, where God is saying who you are, you're here for a purpose, He has gifts for you, the Holy Spirit is in you, you are somebody, maybe you had a rough life, maybe you haven't found it yet, but it's all there.
Right.
Once you have that sense of I am somebody, you can bless somebody else.
Right, right. Wow, beautiful stuff. Here's one. Handling money poorly. Proverbs 17, verse 16. Of what use is money in the hands of a fool, since he has no desire to get wisdom? Now, in a lot of ways, this is a piercing thing to think about, because are we saying that the rich are the ones that are going to have influence? And let's say I don't, you know, I mean, my own childhood, my father was a mechanic, my mother was a factory worker. Now, they handled money extremely well, and they had very little of it, even to the point where when my dad died at 99 in June of 2019, he still had $20,000 in the bank.
Right.
That being 99 years old, being a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
But I always admired, and I learned greatly, because it wasn't how much money he had. He managed what he had wisely.
No, they say, you know, that, you know, family businesses, by the third generation, they've lost it. So people with money can manage it poorly and it's gone and spend it horribly.
Right.
You know, we hear of athletes and stars and so on. They get millions of dollars and soon they're bankrupt.
Right.
So I think it comes down to, you know, discipline. People are not disciplined about this area of their life. And if you're not disciplined in this area of your life, then I don't know if I can trust you again.
Again, it goes back to the need of life coaching and even having badges in management of the resource of money.
Right.
I mean, these are, you know, this is an area, if you're just a spender, and I think there's so many distractions in whether you live in a Western nation or a developing nation, there could be a lot of distractions. And just simple things.
And too, it's hard, when you're in debt, it's hard to be a leader, right?
It's
hard to think of yourself, you know, positively when you're paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah. Right.
And you know, you end up feeling like a failure. Other people are succeeding. Why am I not? Why is everything falling around me? I can't afford anything.
Right.
So it's a cycle of defeats. Whereas if you, you know, like with coaching, you know, learn how to actually manage your money. It can be, if you're not making much money, if you just manage it well, you can still live really well.
Right.
People can live better than most people have lived in the whole history of the earth,
right,
with very little money.
With very little money in the history of the earth today, you can live as good as kings
do. I mean, you know, when I was in seminary, I was in a house. I was in an upstairs apartment. It was $60 a month for that. There was one register with, you know, a box that had heat on it for the whole upstairs. I used to sit on it to do my studying. And we lived that year on $10 a week for our food and everything else. My dad thought it was impossible, so I said, so I kept track of it.
Right.
And, you know, so we managed what little money we had while we were both going to school. And it was a great year because
right,
we were on the way to making a difference in the world. We were going to school and learning, and it didn't matter that our couch was $10 from Goodwill, or, you know, we don't have all these things,
right,
we can't go out to eat. It didn't matter because we were on mission.
Yeah.
And we had a sense of going somewhere. And if you right, have that, it doesn't matter how much you have.
Right.
You have purpose and meaning.
Well, and just think about this. You know, a lot of times Abby tells me stories about vision partners, how they manage and they share $5, $10 a month. But they have to make sure that it comes out exactly on the 16th and not the 14th, because they have managed their life so well that they're giving right, to support right, other people who have less in ministry
right,
training
right,
is so precise. That's what a great job they're doing.
Right.
And they're impacting the world. Right. And it isn't that they've
that's
given
impressive. If someone can, you know, do well with very little, that's an
yes,
impressive person.
It is.
It's easy to do well when you have a lot of money.
It is.
But it's a lot harder if you don't. So that's an impressive person to follow.
Right. 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 Here's another one. Not making friends. Proverbs 17, verse 17. 17, 17. Interesting. A friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. Why is so much influence literature just talking about a bad habit is if someone can't make friends, they're not that influential? Why is that? I mean, you often don't think about friendship as an influential piece.
Yeah. Well, maybe in some ways the biggest influence you have in life are your friends.
Okay.
Those are
so family has to be in your life.
Well, family and friends.
Right.
You know, in some ways, I sometimes wonder, you know, I've been a pastor, and I'm in churches, and I'm preaching, and I'm doing all these things, and you know, and I'm thinking I'm being this big influence with all these things that I do. But maybe that's just what God has me busy with. But the real influence I have is in the cracks along the way. You know, this person that I meet, and
right,
I sort of take him under my wing, and I develop a friendship, and we talk, and we walk outside, and we talk about
right,
the stars and God or whatever. And maybe it's a few people here and there that I really make the biggest difference
right,
with. And that's, I think, you know, and what struck me in Acts chapter 2 when the early church started, you know, they followed the apostles' word, and they met in people's homes, and, you know, that whole thing at the end of
yeah,
Acts
yeah,
chapter 2. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. Okay, there's one word that I never really caught, and it's the word every day.
Right.
It says every day they met in the temple courts and in each other's homes. Every day. And when I reflected on when I was planting a church in Vancouver, I reflected on the people that were making the biggest impact in the church that I was planting. And it was the people that I was connecting with almost every day.
I see.
That the influence
relationship
was, it had to be intense.
Yeah.
Now, I had influence here and there, but
right,
not like, you know, something that made a huge difference. Those people I had contact with almost every single day.
Right.
And that's, I suppose, what a friend is. It's
yeah,
just, you know, someone you see a lot.
Well, there's a skill to making friends, too.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times people will say, I'm an introvert.
Right.
You know, I'm just not good at making friends.
Right.
Okay, so, you know,
so maybe we'll have a coaching badge on how to make friends.
Right.
Right. Because I think, especially a lot of guys are out there, they're more purpose-driven, and a lot of guys don't have a good friend.
Right.
they're married to someone, but they don't have a good friend. And, you know, we can attest that with a good friend, you can attack things and you can try things that you wouldn't
right.
otherwise try.
Right. That's right. Think about friends, too, and just organizationally. You know, I know that as Christian Leaders Institute began, this was a disruptive concept. And many in sort of the education world in the kingdom were a little bit, I remember one meeting we had, and I won't mention any names of the institution, but you and I were at a meeting where someone in this institution, the president and the assistant, were saying things like, this is going to hurt. You got, you know, putting this all free. What's it going to do? And all of that stuff. And I remember we prayerfully went down to the posture of, you know what, no matter what's said, we will always be friends.
Right.
And what's interesting about that whole thing is that comes back to later on to not form enemies with right. another church down the road.
Right.
Or if someone wants to go to that church and then, you know, that church right. is, and then right. you passively, aggressively right. just instead of actually becoming friends with yeah. the minister, maybe learning what the minister does.
Right.
You know, there. I mean, in some ways,
right. Make your enemy your friend,
right?
You know,
right.
Have an influence, or if you're, you know, you go into a church and then the former pastor, you know, is not there anymore. A lot of times, the new pastor has nothing to do with the former pastor
right.
because they're like competitors in
yeah.
some ways. But if you just befriend the former guy, and just, you know, let's say there's some big decision you're trying to make in the church, and you call
right.
him and say, "Hey, what do you think, Bob?" And Bob says, "Well, I think this." And then you go in front of your church and you say, "You know, I was talking with your former pastor, Bob, about this, and he suggested this, and I thought that was a great idea." Now, what happens is everyone that liked Bob is now going to like you.
Right.
Just because you honored Bob.
Right.
So don't make an enemy out of Bob.
Right.
Because, you know, people compare you and Bob.
No, right.
Forget all that and just, you know, look at the positive.
I feel, too, in this one, that concept of a friend loves at all times. I think there's bitterness that's in all of our lives. And there might be somebody that you just can't forgive. Maybe a family member or a mm-hmm. leader in the community or someone that you knew that somehow connected. They spread dissension in your church or in your life. And, you know, it's like I can be friends, but I have like this list of 10 people that I'm not going to be friends with. I'm not going to forgive them. And it's fascinating, I've learned over the years, like, you know, be the first to forgive. Be the first to move on. Be the first to call that person up and find out how they're doing. Be the first that brings peace.
Yeah.
And I find that over the years, that is a powerful way to make an impact because
right.
it's unexpected.
Right.
What's expected is that, yeah, I messed up with that guy and, you know, but
right.
unexpected
right.
is that forgive 70 times 70.
Right.
That's powerfully influential.
Yeah, Jesus said, love your enemies. Maybe another way to say it is make your enemies your friend.
Right.
Treat them like your friend. Like,
right.
like they're your friend and maybe all the good things of friendship will come.
Right. Right. That's powerful.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, here's one. It feels superficial.
Yeah.
Not smiling or practicing positive body language. Proverbs 17:22, a cheerful heart is good medicine, but a crushed spirit dries up the bones.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this noted in the literature as such an influential aspect? A person who practices positive body language is just more influential. It does seem superficial to me, Steve.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's really a good indication of stuff. Like, if you're not smiling, then, you know, you're so serious and intense. How can people deal with that? Or if you don't have a positive body language, it's because you're making a competition out of everything, and
okay.
and you're pushing people away, and you're if you're competing with the people you're trying to influence, then you're not going to influence them.
Right.
So maybe it's an indication of your own self issues.
Right.
Low self-esteem, and that's why you're like this all the time.
Or,
you know, I have a few friends who are like, whenever they talk, they're so intense, and they're, pointing, and it's never, you know, like, we're in this together.
Right.
So sometimes, you know, people, you know, they have an underneath this battling kind of thing. Everything's an argument. Everything's this big battle.
You can see
it in their when they're talking. They got this. So maybe some of the literature suggests if you keep a track of that, don't clench your fists, and maybe you won't be so aggressive in your talk.
Right.
Like, you know, just try to have your hands open. So that'd be a coaching kind of thing. It'd be like, if you have that tendency to do all that, all right, let's practice some positive body language. What would that look like?
Right.
Now let's try that.
Right.
And, you know, people are, you know, they might have a hard time doing it.
Right.
But I think sometimes just doing the positive or smiling once. I remember I said to you about these lectures.
Right.
You are intense and
saying
all this
stuff.
I think you should smile a little bit more. You're so intense that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So, but it's something you'd have to practice, right?
Yep.
It's and then all of a sudden, if you are smiling,
right,
you do get lighter,
right?
So,
well, and I feel too like there's a self-discipline to smiling.
Okay.
That when you had mentioned that to me, you know, in some ways, I'm a smiley kind of person anyway.
Right.
Off the record.
Right. Yeah, it was when the camera came on.
It starts smiling. You know, well, in sometimes it's like there are blocks in your life that a coach can help you see.
Right.
That have nothing to do other than just playing as a bad habit.
Right.
And you want to get over that bad habit.
Right. Right. So some people are, you know, they sit like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I am genuinely interested in what you got to say, but it doesn't look like it.
Right. Right. Or here's the one that a lot of people do this.
Yeah.
And I'm a closed person.
Now, maybe I'm not being closed right now, but it feels that way.
It does. So there's an example that in ministry in that when you're talking to someone, like going like this is a body language characteristic. But there are more.
Right.
In a life coach, minister, and influence,
right,
or even in the people smart area,
right,
might help you.
Or even in the communication area where, you know, you're giving a sermon and your body is not listening to the words you're saying.
Right.
And so there's a disconnect between the words that you're saying and your body. Like, let's be together on this, and your hands are around and you're almost doing it,
right,
then people can see it and they can feel
right
it. But if you're like, you know, we got to get together and do this.
Yeah, yeah. It just doesn't have
the same impact. So,
right. Well, and some of you had a family where body language was so repressed that you don't even know what body language communicates openness and what body language communicates anger or closes.
Right.
You're not even, you can't make that differentiation.
Right.
And there's where the life coach need may come in.
Or some people think they're being enthusiastic, you know, but when you show the film back, you know, they're like, and then they raise their finger like this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah,
they
yeah
thought it was like this.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, we gotta! And it was like,
we gotta! I remember when we did a early in Christian Leaders Institute, Steve did a class on preaching and presentation, and he did this activity of fee-fi-fum-fum. And all he asked everybody to do was to do it as most dramatic as possible, because he wanted people to give a little more emotion in their preaching. And it was fascinating that some of the family backgrounds, they were going fee-fi-fum-fum, and they thought they were at the limit of their emotions.
Yes. And then I'd ask him, okay, now add 10 times more emotion to that. Fee-fi, fo-fum.
It was
10 times?
Yeah.
All right, 100 times.
Yeah. A million times.
Yes.
But it illustrates that the power of body language.
Right.
And
it can be learned. And,
right.
And a lot of times your emotion can follow that.
Yes.
But at first, it's like learning to play the piano.
Right.
It's just something you have to learn. When you move in,
right,
it's more intense.
Right.
When you sit back, it's more relaxed.
Right.
Right. When you look so, you know, when you're talking about something and then you all of a sudden look someone in the eye, it becomes way more dramatic.
Right.
You know, you people really need to know the Lord. And so, you know,
right.
finally look straight into your eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, some people, you know, they're reading their sermon. It's really good to know the Lord. And it just yeah. doesn't have the punch.
So in a lot of ways, this is interpersonal. That is to have a smiling, cheerful heart. But at public speaking,
right.
So this is like a, you can see now why the literature talks like this.
Right.
It's not just superficial.
No. And it's not just in public speaking. If you're like trying to mentor somebody,
right.
but you never look at them when you say anything.
Right.
Or you never, your body language doesn't express that I'm proud of you. Wow, you did a great job.
Right.
You know, then your influence is less.
Okay, the last one for this presentation is complaining about your parents. There is talk about that, about how that sets, you know, often you talk about the wise woman tears down her house, a wise parent can tear it down. But it can go the opposite way, that if you complain about your parents or the leaders in your church, and in some ways this is that generational, where you are of one generation, maybe a child, or you are an employee of a company.
Right.
You know, the application for this, you know, a foolish son brings grief to his father and bitterness to the one who bore him. In a lot of ways, this the leadership principle or influence talked about in the literature is those who are, in a sense, employees or those who are children of subordinates, wherever, have a culture of complaining
yes.
about the authorities in charge of them
yes.
or the ones above them,
right.
and it will hurt their influence.
And I have a good illustration of that. You know, I planted a church in Vancouver, and the home missions of our denomination was sort of in charge of that, and there was a
right.
regional guy that was in charge of me, and he was home missions. And he would meet with me, and he would meet with our church, but he was old-fashioned. He hadn't planted a church
yeah.
in 30 years, and, you know, he wasn't on the cutting edge at all. And when he would meet with our people, and then when he was done, I would, you know, I'd sort of give out my people the impression, like, well, what does he know?
Right.
What does Home Missions know? We're the ones out here doing
it. We're on the front lines.
We're on the front lines. And we're the young people, and we're going to, you know.
We're the champions.
Yeah. So what happened, though, is three years later, you know, I had a really good leader that wanted to, you know, start, you know, be involved in ministry and so on. But, you know, what he wanted to be was like me.
Right.
Okay, and what he saw me doing, he saw me wanting to be the king on the hill.
Right.
You know, the home missions, what do they know? I know more than they do. And so, 3 years later, that young guy is saying that to me.
Or about you.
Yeah, he's saying he knows it more, and I'm not the home missions guy because that's what I did. He's
right.
he's doing exactly what I did, and so when I reflected on it, I wish I had said, you know, the home missions people, they don't know everything,
mm-hmm.
but let me tell you, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for them.
Right.
If I found something to honor those people,
right.
then I would have gotten people that would do the same thing to me. Steve
right.
doesn't know everything. But I'll tell you, I wouldn't be here for what they'd be saying the same words.
I remember in this point we've talked about in 20 years ago, actually. I remember how you reflected on Moses and Joshua,
right.
that Moses had nothing but a hassle,
right.
and but Joshua did better. I remember Steve saying that, he said, "Well, maybe it could be that the Joshua generation was it." Generation that, you know, that did not fight with its past, that did
no.
not de-edify
well,
the leaders.
Moses, the people watching Moses had no example to follow other than Moses. Moses
right.
came out of nowhere, I am in charge,
right.
and they rebelled. But Joshua spent 40 years modeling to everybody
right.
how you treat a leader.
Right.
And he followed
and he
Moses
treated
and helped
Joshua.
Moses. So when Moses died and Joshua took over, he had been training the people how they should treat him.
Right.
By wow. how he had treated Moses.
Well, and you think about that in the parenting thing. If you treat your parents well as they get older,
right.
you are teaching your children
yes.
You know, a couple of my daughters have been saying, well, we're going to get you when you're older. And no, we're going to get you when we're older. It's because I had my parents live with us for 8 years.
Right.
And then after that, they lived in our same town. Right. And when
we tried to look after them.
We tried to look after them. I mean, we're not grading, grading anybody else. I'm just saying, we loved it too.
Right.
But we did show that
right.
that, hey, take care of your parents.
Right. I think, you know, just complaining in general, not just about your parents, but just being a complaining person.
Yeah.
No one wants to follow that.
No. Actually, that's really maybe the material issue. You could say this, complain about your work, complain about the government, complain about, you know, your sports team, complain about your parents, complain about your spouse.
Right. You're saying you're a victim.
Right.
And you have to decide whether you want to be a victim or a leader.
Right.
You can't be both.
Right. Well, at that, we'll conclude this one, and we look forward to seeing you on the next presentation.